Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of July. Our guest this hour is the author of Neoconservatism, the Biography of a Movement. Julian Vais is with us. He's a senior fellow and director of the research at the Center of the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Justin is a French expert on American foreign policy, France, and Europe. He served as a special advisor on the United States and transatlantic relations at the policy planning staff of the French Foreign Ministry. He is an adjunct professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and is the author, co-author, or editor of several books on the United States, especially on American foreign policy. We welcome phone calls for Justin Vais. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation this hour. Hi, Justin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Most people, I think, when you hear the word, now we were doing so many shows on what neoconservatism is and how it was influencing particularly the Bush administration. I think most of us think that it's gone. It's over. I don't know what all those people are doing right now. But you write in the book that it still has an influence and that these kinds of movements ebb and flow and that it may have more of an influence down the road. What is the current influence of the neoconservative movement?
Well, obviously, the neoconservative movement is not influential with the Obama administration. However, it is still influential in debates, in foreign policy debates in Washington, debates that are so political and intellectual debates that are so important to define the parameters, I would say, of American foreign policy. And also, they are still very influential in the Republican Party, meaning that of the different schools of thought, if you'd like, among Republicans about what to do on foreign policy, neoconservatives still do have a very strong voice and are influential with some of the main figures of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. It's not really a party thing, though. I think that you say that it's more of an intellectual kind of argument. These are people who think about these issues. Is it fair to call them intellectuals?
Yeah, I think so. The first thing to keep in mind is that they are definitely not a grassroots movement. They are not a mass movement. They are really a bunch of intellectuals, journalists, op-ed writers, researchers, mostly in Washington, D.C. and New York City. You wouldn't find many neoconservatives in Boise, Idaho or wherever. They are really concentrated where power is, and they are, if you'd like, advisors to the prince. They always have been during their history, and so it's as an intellectual force that they count, not as an electoral force of any sort.
You talk about these different sides, that they are an integral part of current American foreign policy debates with realists and liberals as their main sparring partners.
Yes. Roughly speaking, you have three or four important schools of thought in American foreign policy. Isolationists don't count much, actually, whether they're from the right or from the left. Those who advocate not necessarily a retreat of America from the world, but at least I would say much more restraint and much less interventionism, they're definitely not in the majority, and they're almost negligible in Washington, D.C. That leaves us with more or less three schools of thought. One is the realists, and you know, you can find them both in the among Republicans and Democrats. Robert Gates, for example, who was more of a Republican, is now serving as Secretary of Defense for Obama and also served as Secretary of Defense for Bush, and is a good example of the realist school. It's the old tradition of Nixon and Kissinger, Colin Powell, James Baker. Realists think that regimes don't matter, that it's important to defend American interests regardless and negotiate with other countries regardless of whether they're democracies or autocracies, and have a sort of cynical, if you'd like, approach to foreign policy. Liberals insist on the importance of international institutions, of interdependence, etc., and they tend to be more on the democratic side. And third important school of thought, the neoconservatives, are defending a vision in which America must shape the world, must be interventionist, if you'd like, because if it fails to shape the world, then world order will be shaped by other nations, other powers, in ways that could be inimical or detrimental to U.S. interest. And so they combine a sort of assertiveness with an importance that they give to military force and to the balance of power, and the importance they give to regime. They consider that the more democracies there are, the safer America will be, and the more peaceful the world will be. So that's more or less the differences between the three main schools of thought.
Neoconservatives don't seem to have much use for the United Nations. Why is that?
Well, very early on, and as soon as the 60s and 70s, people like Scoop Jackson, the famous senator from the state of Washington, who was a very important figure in the neoconservative movement, were very skeptical of the UN because they were arguing that what keeps the peace is not the UN Security Council, where you had countries like the USSR at the time, etc., but what kept the peace and what kept America safe was its military might, and that on the contrary, multilateral institutions such as the UN and international law were almost threatening to American interests because it was sort of tying America down, tying it up, and preventing America from doing all what is necessary to defend itself and to ensure, you know, the fate of the free world. And so, so they are neoconservatives are generally skeptical that international institutions and especially the UN can do any good to American interest and to the interest of democracy worldwide.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the mark on the Afghanistan and human rights debates, that the neoconservative movement now is still making its mark on Afghanistan. Can you tell me how it's doing so?
Well, yes, certainly the currently neoconservatives are the main defenders of staying the course in Afghanistan and even doubling down in order to make sure that the Taliban don't come back. And this is for two reasons, at least. The first one is the lesson of history is that if we leave Afghanistan, and as we did more or less in the 1990s after the USSR stopped its invasion and withdrew its troops, then something like what happened in the 1990s, meaning Al-Qaeda, a link between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, might once again plot against America and plot against the rest of the Western world. And the second reason is that if we fail to install at least a semi-stable regime in Afghanistan and ideally a democratic regime, even though that might be a tall order, then in the long term there's a risk that this regime would be discredited, and that will get to the first problem, which was victory of the Taliban. That's why they're insisting on winning, and also for, I would say, the reputation of the U.S. If other countries and other insurgency forces see that the U.S. can just be chased away from one country by an insurgency, then it's bad for America's image and for future interventions where needed. So they are pretty much on the side of Barack Obama on this particular subject, which is to do a surge of troops and try to ensure a dose of stability in Afghanistan.
So on this particular issue, could you say that Obama is a neoconservative?
No, because his aim and his vision of the world are definitely not neoconservatives. He's a mix of a realist and a liberal on international issue, and he he doesn't put as much emphasis on military force and military might as neoconservatives do. Neither does he put so much emphasis on America's ability to sort of shape the world and in particular promote democracy in a muscular way, which is one of the points that neoconservatives insist on. So no, it's just an objective conjunction of objectives, if you like, of aims in Afghanistan, but no, he's no neocon on that.
Yeah, but it is interesting when you describe what his vision is in the world and how the war is being conducted and the criticism of the war in Afghanistan. He's conducting himself, many would say, in a way that's quite dissimilar from what he presents himself as a realist, as a person who believes in negotiation, etc.
Well, yes and no. First of all, he always argued, starting in 2001 and 2002, that Afghanistan was the right war, right? As opposed, his famous speech in 2002, to the Iraq war, which he very early on described as the wrong war. And so, and the reason for this is pretty basic. It is because 9/11 was plotted, somewhere between Afghanistan and the western part of Pakistan, and because of the conjunction between Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which actually attacked the U.S. on 9/11, unlike Iraq. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that he inherited this war, and a war that had gone badly, partly because so many resources were diverted to Iraq starting in 2002 and 2003, that the situation, which seemed to be more or less under control very early on in 2002, 2003, 2004, gradually deteriorated. And so when he came into power a year ago, a year and a half ago, he found a situation which was really, really critical, and hence the long hesitations about what to do, whether doing the surge that he ended up choosing or trying to limit the engagement and do things with a lighter footprint. But it doesn't necessarily follow that he's, I would say, a believer in the necessity of intervening worldwide and imposing America's vision and, throwing America's weight around like neoconservatives would advocate.
You mentioned Scoop Jackson, a name I haven't thought of in a long time. Can you give us an idea of, because most of us think neoconservatism, Paul Wolfowitz, the Bush administration, actually, it's a fairly recent philosophy, and yet your book traces this way back, that it had that it had different kinds of phases. Can you tell us about the evolution of neoconservatism?
Sure. Actually, the name, the label, appeared at the end of the 60s and early 70s in a very different context, which was that of domestic debate, and neoconservatives were actually liberals at that time, who dissented from a certain number of developments in the 60s, like the rise of the new left, the counterculture, student revolt, and also social engineering, the many aspects of the war and poverty that LBJ was conducting, the use of quotas, for example, to do affirmative action, etc. These liberals started dissenting from the mainstream, I would say the mainstream of liberalism, saying that we ought to be more prudent, that government was overreaching, and that the student revolt, etc., were threatening the basis of society. And so their enemies in the new left started labeling them new conservatives or neoconservatives in order to sort of banish them from liberalism and sort of demonstrate that they were really conservatives. They were people like Irving Kristol, like Danielle Bell, like Pat Moynihan, etc. And they were still liberals, and they were really interested in domestic issues. And then very rapidly, they linked up with another group around Scoop Jackson, precisely, who were called the Scoop Jackson Democrats. And it's sort of the same story, meaning that the new left started making inroads in the Democratic Party, with the especially with the selection of George McGovern as candidate in 1972 against Nixon. And McGovern was seen as way too much to the left. He was advocating social engineering. He was advocating a hasty retreat from Vietnam, etc. And so some Democrats, some Cold War Democrats, really dissented very strongly from that and tried to steer the Democratic Party back to the center. And they were called Skupjackson Democrats, or they were called also neoconservatives. And there were people like Jean Kirkpatrick, for example, Richard Pearl, who was a legislative aide to Skupjackson, Elliot Abrams, and many others. And in the end, they lost the battle for the Democratic Party, and so they switched over to Reagan in 1980, during the campaign of 1980, because Reagan was offering the sort of foreign policy type, the foreign policy direction that they were that was more to their liking in terms of asserting American power, being more muscular and aggressive against the USSR, etc., even though they dissented with his domestic politics. To make a long story short, they lost the battle inside the Democratic Party, and so they really became Republicans, and that's the real birth of the neoconservatives. They were really Democrats who were hawkish on foreign policy and who were generally progressive on domestic politics, but you know, soon thereafter, they sort of abandoned everything there. And so that leads us to the current state of affairs in the 1990s and 2000s, where neoconservatives are really Republicans for most of them, and they're really a foreign policy school of thought. They're not interested in domestic politics much. They're really a foreign policy group, and they're advocating this sort of active and proactive, I would say, and assertive stance for America vis-a-vis the world. That's the short story of neoconservatism, which is a very complex movement.
Oh, Justin, you're good. You did all of that in a few minutes. That was very well done. We're going to welcome phone calls for Justin. Justin Valles is our guest. Justin Valles is the author of Neoconservatism, the Biography of a Movement, which has just been published. He has an interesting background. Obviously, you can tell he is French, and he is the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, adjunct professor of European Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and author of Neoconservatism, the Biography of a Movement. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join us and talk about the current influence of neoconservatives or the history of neoconservatism. We have phone lines open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Justin, and our calls start with Peter in Cottage Grove. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I'd like to ask the guest, first off, I'm finding this very, very interesting. I love history. I'd like to ask the guest how Hubert Humphrey, our neighbor from Minnesota, fits into this period of American politics.
Okay.
That's a very good question, and actually Hubert Humphrey played a very important role with Skupjackson Democrats, not the least because he was linked with Jean and Evren Kirkpatrick as early as the 40s and 50s, and the two of them were, I would say, an influential couple in academia, in political science, and there was a very strong Minnesota connection here. Also with Max Kempelman, who is also a Skupjackson Democrat and also linked to Hubert Humphrey. So he was linked to several figures of the Skupjackson Democrats, and they supported him, especially, of course, in 1968 when he ran for the succession of his president and boss, Lyndon Johnson. And Humphrey was the last, for them, for the Skupjackson Democrats, he was the last embodiment of Cold War liberalism, meaning a strong progressive stance at home and a resolute anti-communism abroad. And for them, 1968 and Humphrey's candidacy was the last sort of the swan song, if you'd like, of Cold War liberalism, because then afterwards, of course, he was beaten by George McGovern in 1972, and of course he was not really present in 1976. He decided not to run for re-election, and even though he sort of was an opponent or a competitor, I would say, to Skupjackson, the the two, there was a strong compatibility, if you'd like, between followers of Humphrey and Scoop Jackson. Humphrey never was a neoconservative in the modern sense of the term, but he was close to many of them. And once again, this mix of progressivism at home and anti-communism abroad made him a figure that was liked and close to many of the Scoop Jackson Democrats, also known as neoconservatives in the 70s.
But it also did him in terms of becoming president, right? That was such an incredibly divisive war in this country that the neoconservative idea of fighting in the Vietnam War, but Humphrey lost. Many people thought he should have been president, but he later changed his mind on the war, but he couldn't have become president considering what he wanted to do in Vietnam. Is that fair?
Well, two things about that. The first thing is that what really tied him up was the fact that Johnson insisted on him not differentiating himself from Johnson, meaning that he couldn't disavow the war and take a different stance, which presumably could have helped him during the 1968 election. So he had his hands, at least one hand, tied behind his back. And that's certainly one big factor in his loss in 1968 against Nixon. The second thing is that neoconservatism in foreign policy really appeared in the 70s, not with the Vietnam War, but as a reaction against the reaction against the Vietnam War, if that's not too complicated, meaning that many neoconservatives actually opposed the Vietnam War or were skeptical of it. But what they really and so they, you know, they debated a bit, about the merits of the Vietnam War. But what they all agreed on was that the reaction following the Vietnam War, the mix of isolationism, criticism of America, anti-Americanism that flowed from the rejection of the Vietnam War was more dangerous than the mistakes that had been done in Vietnam. And so what really gave birth to neoconservatism was a reaction against that whole rejection of the Vietnam War. Neoconservatives and Scoop Jackson Democrats thought that the reaction had been carried way too far and that way beyond just debating the merits of the war, but towards incriminating America as, you know, as imperialistic, as inherently bad, etc. That's what they reacted against, and that's how neoconservatism really was born. Also, a defense of the values that America, in their eyes, should stand for: human rights, democracy, etc. It's that mix that really gave birth to neoconservatism in the 70s.
Interesting. Thank you, Peter, for your call. Paul is next on the road. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I have a question about whether there is a recognition of domestic policy in current neoconservative thought, or is their worldview still largely international? I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, Paul.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and the short answer is no. There is nothing. You know, for example, if you take the Weekly Standard, which is the magazine that Bill Kristol, who's Irving Kristol's son, puts out every week, obviously, it's not very different on domestic issue. It's not very different from, say, the National Review. Where it's different is really on foreign policy. There is a debate going on among conservatives and among Republicans about foreign policy, and neoconservatives are really have their now. I'm really speaking of the current decade, are really having their particular identity, if you'd like, is really in foreign policy. And there's nothing much that distinguishes them from other conservatives. They might insist a bit more on they might be more tolerant, I would say, of big government, because they think that, you know, for example, defense and foreign policy, the budget, the defense budget should be increased. And so obviously that doesn't square off very easily with the general conservative requirement that government be kept small. So in a sense, their foreign policy views sometimes, I would say, give a coloration or give a special bent to their domestic views. But more or less, they are really only a foreign policy movement.
The New York Times review of your book says this. The reviewer got this from the book, and tell me if this is accurate. There seems to be no war neoconservatives won't eagerly fight, no arms program they won't happily support. Reagan wasn't combative enough for them. Even as the Soviet Union was collapsing, neocons were warning of a growing Russian menace.
Yes, no, that's one of the aspects of neoconservatism, is sort of the exaggeration or alarmism, if you'd like, that they displayed throughout their history since the 1970s. And sometimes they were right, in the sense that when they were warning against the gains that the USSR was making, they had sort of a point in the mid-1970s, but very soon afterwards, they really exaggerated the threat greatly, which was partly sincere, because they really believed that America was becoming number two and that America should spend more on defense, etc., and partly instrumental, if you like, or calculated, in order to obtain more funding for defense and foreign affairs, etc. So sort of, you know, exaggerating the threat is the first thing you would do in order to get more defense. And nowadays, it's true that not a year has passed by without neoconservatives asking for a larger defense budget, which is simply linked to their worldview. They think that in order to maintain world order, and in order to maintain a friendly environment for the U.S. should be able to intervene and, I would say, police the world more or less. And in order to do that, spending 4 or 4.5% of GDP is not such, in their view, is not such a big expenditure given the magnitude of the task. And so that's why they think that even now, defense budget should be increased.
And yet, would it be fair to say that their philosophy of increased military budget and a very strong military simply won't fly when you have a U.S. economy that's in the doldrums, if not worse?
Well, yes and no, because what the answer, I personally agree that you have trade-offs, and that it's probably not wise to increase greatly the defense budget now. But what their answer is that, first of all, defense spending is not that high. It's high in absolute terms, if you'd like. It's close to $600 or $700 billion a year. But compared to with GDP, it's 4 or 4.5%, which historically is not really very, very high. Second, they argue that if you need shovel-ready projects for the stimulus, then defense spending is ideal, because it puts American workers to work, and at the same time it provides America with more means to defend itself and assume its responsibilities vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And so lastly, they argue that this is ultimately for the well-being of the nation on the long term. It's more important to ensure world order and America's safety rather than spend too much on social programs.
Mm-hmm. What kind of influence, Justin, did the neoconservatives have in the Bush administration, the second Bush administration?
That's a very important question, because very often we've seen exaggerations and even conspiracy theory saying that neoconservatives that somehow controlled Bush starting in 2001, etc. Actually, they were one voice, one important voice, but just one voice in the mix of different opinions and strands of thought, if you'd like, that contributed to Bush's foreign policy. Neither Colin Powell nor Condoleezza Rice were neoconservatives, and only you could say Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld were not neoconservatives themselves, but they were close to the neoconservatives. And you have to get to the second tier of officials, Paul Wolfowitz, for example, or Duke Fife in the Pentagon, to find really true neoconservative figures. So yes, they added their voice to the, I would say, to the internal debate in the administration, but they did not control that administration. They influenced it both through neoconservative figures inside the administration, and of course through the public debate, through op-eds, publication, whether in the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, in the Weekly Standard, in commentary, and other outlets. Mm-hmm.
Our number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join our conversation. And we're talking with the author of Neoconservatism, the Biography of a Movement. Ken Milton is our next caller. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I wondered, is President Ronald Reagan, or was President Ronald Reagan considered a neoconservative? And would we have neoconservatives if Karl Rove was not around?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and one that is not very easy to answer, because if you look at his biography, Reagan, after all, was a former Democrat. He was even involved in a trade union in the 1940s in Hollywood, and then he turned Republican afterwards. So he did this sort of whiteboard evolution that so many neoconservatives experienced as well. But then now, if you look at his actual foreign policy, yeah, you could say that in his first term, Reagan was heavily influenced by neoconservatives, people I mentioned like Jim Kirkpatrick, who was his ambassador to the UN, or you know, Elliot Abrams, Richard Pearl, and a few others. And what he took from neoconservatives, or you know, how the way neoconservatives reinforced his pre-existing opinions, was in insisting, for example, on democracy, the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, the Reagan Doctrine, the idea of harassing the Soviet Empire through the support for the so-called freedom fighters, whether in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, or in Central America, or in Eastern Africa, or elsewhere, or for example, the rhetoric about the evil empire, the ash heap of history to which the USSR was consigned, or the very tough stance on arms control. So the first Reagan, the Reagan of 81 to 84, more or less, was pretty close to the neoconservatives in his policy. But then that's where it becomes confusing, because in the second mandate, Reagan was very different. Reagan sort of distanced himself from his neoconservative advisor, to their dismay, and Reagan, to his credit, understood that Gorbachev, who got in power in 1985, was someone he could do business with, meaning that it was more important to let Gorbachev do his reforms, the perestroika and the glasnost, do his reforms, and let him some space to breathe, if you'd like, in order for him not to be pressured by the Soviet hardliners, by the Politburo. And so he started sort of lessening the tensions with the USSR in the second mandate. He started negotiating arms control deals, etc. And so that was a very different Reagan, who was harshly criticized by the neoconservatives. But probably, you know, when we say, you know, Reagan won the Cold War, the irony is that he probably contributed to winning the Cold War as much with his smart stance of the second mandate of letting Gorbachev do his reforms, which ultimately led to the demise of the USSR, as much with that as with the first stance during the first mandate of being really tough on the Soviets. So he's a very interesting figure in this sense, and it's understandable how neoconservatives can claim him as their own, whereas realist and others would object that the second Reagan was definitely not neoconservative.
Hmm. Anything else, Ken?
The importance of Karl Rove.
Yes, right. I forgot.
Right. No. Karl Rove does not figure very prominently here. Karl Rove is really, first, he's not a foreign policy person, if you'd like. He's not interested. He's not that knowledgeable in foreign policy. He's really a tactician, a politician in this sense, in the domestic sense of the term, and he doesn't have much interest of patients for the neocons. He was more interested in making sure that George W. Bush was winning elections and trying to engineer a durable Republican majority than in any foreign policy consideration of world order, of primacy, etc. So he's not central, definitely not central to this history.
Thank you so much for your call, Ken. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest is Justin Vais. He is the author of Neoconservatism, The Biography of a Movement. It looks at the three distinct stages of neoconservatism, beginning in New York with a group of liberal intellectuals who reacted against the counterculture of the 60s. We need to talk more about that. Then we have Scoop Jackson Democrats, and then we have the neoconservatism that most of us are more familiar with, emerging in the 1990s. Neocons were Republicans, espousing an adventurous agenda of national greatness. We'll continue and look at some of the phrases and philosophies that are associated with neoconservatism, and I'll give you a couple of those examples, and you'll be surprised, I think, by who embrace them. But we certainly welcome more of your phone calls, or you can just listen. It's up to you. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neoconservatism. We're talking about its history in this country with the author of Neoconservatism, The Biography of a Movement. Justin Vais is our guest this hour. And again, our phone number is 800-486-8655. Let's take a call from Fish Creek. Kathy is calling from there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm just calling. I have a question your guest would comment on the Project for a New American Century and the people involved in it and what effect that has had on our political scene in the last 10 years.
Okay.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The Project for the New American Century was born in 1997, and it was really created by Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, who are two prominent figures of the current neoconservative movement. And it was actually a very, very small operation. It was a small think tank located in Washington, D.C., with four, five, or six people at most, but which got, I would say, a big bang for the buck in the sense that he sent, it sort of gathered signatures of prominent people sending so public letters, especially to Bill Clinton, asking, for example, for action on Iraq. I would add not necessarily an invasion in 1997, 1998, but at least some kind of action on Iraq and intervening on other important foreign policy issues. And so it got significantly influential. Once again, it was one voice in the debate, and thanks to the I would say public relation talents of people like Bill Kristol and others, it got a very strong audience compared with its initial size. And so after that, there was probably some exaggeration about PNAC, which is that entity, the Project for the New American Century, saying that they had sort of mastermind the Iraq invasion, etc. Their influence shouldn't be exaggerated, and their influence on the Bush administration in particular should not be exaggerated. There were quite a few tensions between neoconservatives of PNAC and other outlets and the Bush administration. For example, before 9/11, there were strong disagreements about what to do on foreign policy. And even after that, for example, in the run-up to the Iraq War, there were strong tensions with the Bush administration, where obviously you had some neoconservatives, but as I mentioned before, who were not necessarily in position of deciding everything. Tensions about, for example, how to do the invasion, how many troops to commit to the ground invasion of Iraq. And on the one hand, you had Donald Rumsfeld, who was committed to the invasion but wanted to do it on the cheap, if you'd like, or at least wanted to show that America could invade Iraq with few troops who were lean and mean, etc. And on the other hand, you had neoconservatives who argued that This should be done well, and the way to do it well was to commit a large number of troops in order to make sure that after the invasion, Iraq would be stable and could be turned into something resembling a democracy. And they actually lost that battle in the sense that what happened, we all know what happened, was that there were too few invasion troops
yes.
and too few troops to maintain order after the invasion, and that led to the deterioration of the very rapid deterioration of the situation in the spring and summer of 2003 in Iraq. So this is just to show that PNAC was influential and was an important voice, but also had disagreement with the Bush administration over the exact conduit of the war.
Anything else, Kathy? Oh, Kathy's gone. Thank you. Interesting question. And what about the influence now? Is it mostly through publications? And if so, what are those?
Yeah, it's really an intellectual movement. And so the main outlets are the Weekly Standard is certainly one. Commentary magazine published in New York is another one. The editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal are a fair reflection of neoconservative thought in foreign policy issues. And then a couple of think tanks in Washington, D.C., where you would find a number of neocons, AEI, obviously, the American Enterprise Institute, mm-hmm. the Hudson Institute, the Foreign Policy Initiative, which is a very sort of brand new, it's 1 year old, a small think tank closely resembling the PNAC, which we just talked about. So the presence is still pretty significant. And of course, you know, obviously the intervention of neoconservative figures like Paul Wolfowitz or Bob Kagan or Bill Kristol in the more mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the premises of the important guiding philosophies of neoconservatism in the book. And, you know, you don't think some of the people that you bring up are surprises because you don't think about them as having expressed neoconservative thoughts. The indispensable nation, primacy, can be summarized by a few expressions. You talk about the indispensable nation used by Madeleine Albright, of all people, the benevolent empire, the unipolar moment. That all sounds a little lofty, but a little bit vague, and yet it's a very important part of this movement. What does that mean, to be the indispensable nation?
Well, yeah, that's a sentence that Madeleine Albright used, I think, back in 1997. It doesn't make her a neoconservative, but it makes her, I would say, a liberal interventionist, meaning someone who believes that America can use its power for worthy causes like stopping genocide, ensuring the defense of nations that are threatened by their neighbors and the like, and you've seen a sort of conjunction between two movements: the better known neoconservative movement on the one hand, and the liberal, the ones who have been called the liberal hoax, or sometimes the neoliberals, who are really liberal thinkers, but who think that in certain cases, like Bosnia, for example, in 1995, or Kosovo in 1999, or even Afghanistan, that it was the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, was to intervene and use American power. And so you have this sort of proximity between some in the liberal camp, precisely like Madeleine Albright, or like, for example, Michael McFaul, who's now an advisor on Russia to President Obama, on the one hand, and neoconservatives on the other hand.
This idea of a firm belief in the need for the United States to play an active role in the world, you talk about that as the first and foremost basic tenet of neoconservatism. Can you expand on that a little bit? What role should we be playing, active role in the world?
Well, the first principle or the first premise of neoconservatism is that it's an internationalist movement, meaning, and that's a sort of a very basic division between isolationist and internationalist. Isolationists believe that America should do less in the world, should not be entangled in alliances, should not commit itself everywhere, should not be the policeman of the world, etc. And you have isolationists from the left who condemn American imperialism and, you know, greed, etc., or isolationists from the right who think that government should be kept at a minimum, government should be small, including people in the Tea Party movement, for example, or libertarians, etc. Against these two types of isolationism, most of the American elite are internationalists, meaning that they consider that America should play an active role in the world, should have allies and maintain strong alliances, and should intervene when necessary, etc. It's just the modalities of this intervention, of this active role, that are debated among the schools that I mentioned, the liberals, the neoconservatives, and the realists. And so, yeah, the first aspect of neoconservatism is that they strongly believe that America should be active in the world and should shape world order, if you'd like, should intervene and ensure that its ideals and ideas and interests are defended and promoted, because basically America cannot count on international institutions or on other powers to look after its interests and ideals.
We've heard that there was some, and I'd like for you to explain how much tension there was between Colin Powell and neoconservatives in the Bush administration, or advising the administration.
Well, that was a simple reflection of the very important and longstanding tension or division between neoconservatives and realists. And Colin Powell is indeed a realist. He's skeptic that America should throw its weight around and intervene everywhere, as he accuses neoconservatives of advocating. He is in favor of negotiating with all kinds of regime, even regimes we don't like, because that's just good policy to defend American interests, etc. And so this sort of general vision, close to what Nixon or Bush 41, Bush the father, position was, or James Baker or Brent Scowcroft, and figures like this, who are all realists, put him at odds with the more hawkish advisors of or officials in the Bush administration, including neoconservatives, but also including Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And so, yes, there was a strong tension between the two that was in the first Bush administration, which was generally resolved with a victory by the hawkish camp, for example, Iraq, the decision to invade Iraq. And in the second Bush administration was generally resolved in favor of the realists. Colin Powell was gone in the second Bush administration, but Condoleezza Rice really turned out to replace him as a voice for realism rather than neoconservatism, and having a policy that was much more close to realist lines.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about the Tea Party. Is there any part of Tea Party philosophy that is associated with neoconservative thought?
Well, no. On the contrary, I should premise my comments by saying that there is no unified program of the Tea Party. So obviously, it's very difficult to talk about it. And even more importantly, there is no there has been no pronouncement or speeches about foreign policy. So it's kind of difficult to know exactly where the Tea Party supporters stand. But we do have an idea, and that idea is simple, is that many libertarians or Tea Party supporters are against big government and big taxation. And obviously, one of the main expenditures of the state is foreign policy and more precisely, the defense budget. And so people like Ron Paul or Rand Paul, his son, and other figures have been very skeptical of the interventionism preached by neoconservatives. And so you have a tension inside the conservative movement on foreign policy over whether it's smart to once again throw America's weight around and intervene everywhere, etc., at great cost, and also with the added cost that it increases the reach of government, including in the U.S., through the intelligence agencies, through the Pentagon, etc. And so we've seen examples of this tension in the recent, even in the recent weeks over Afghanistan. Remember just a week ago when chairman of the Republican Party, Steele, made his comments about Afghanistan being Obama's war.
Right.
Well, you know, obviously was wrong in that Bush had started the Afghanistan war, but at the same time, he was expressing something deeper, which is that for many libertarians and Tea Party supporters, yes, this was an seen as really a waste of money, and this was sort of mirroring the opinion of other pundits on the Republican right, like George Will, for example, who's a famous columnist for the Washington Post, who have been fighting the neocons over the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and have been advocating, if not a retreat from Afghanistan, at least have been fighting the surge of troops there. So that leaves us with a very interesting question for this election cycle, and more importantly, the next one, 2012, which is whether the main Republican candidates for the nomination will be more on the libertarian side of reducing America's commitments mm-hmm. abroad, or whether they will side more with the neoconservatives. If you take Sarah Palin, for example.
And on that note, I'm sorry, we're out of time, Justin. Justin Vais, our guest, he is the author of Neoconservatism, the Biography of a Movement. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. I'll be with you again on Monday. Just a reminder that Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird, wonderful performance in that movie. The book celebrates its 50th birthday this year. Will be with us as part of our 10 o'clock show, so be sure and tune in.